morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loride. Well, this month, WMNF is celebrating diversity and looking at the diverse range of people that make up our country. And today on Radioactivity, we're going to hear a really terrific speech by one of the most brilliant people out there. He is Mark Charles, a Native American activist. He's a journalist. He writes for Sojourners Magazine. He was an independent candidate for president of the U.S. in 2020, although he was only on the ballot in one state. He's the son of a Navajo father and a Dutch American mother. He grew up in New Mexico, and he's a former pastor at the Christian Indian Center in Denver, Colorado, and he's also a consultant for the Calvin Institute of Christian Worship. He's known for denouncing the doctrine of discovery and for his opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline. He's going to give us insight into the American Indian experience, and that's coming up next right here on WMNF in Tampa. This is a speech by Mark R. Charles.
Yat'e. Yat'e. Mark Charles Yinishia. Tsin Bake Janan Nishlin, Do Tohiglini Bashachin, Tsin Bake Janan Bashache, Do Tolachit Ni Bashanella. So, in the Navajo culture, when you introduce yourself, you always give your four clans. We're a matrilineal society, and so our identities come from our mother's mother. My mother's mother is actually American of Dutch heritage, and so when I introduce myself, I say Tsin Bake Dene'e, which translated means the wooden shoe people. My father's mother, because they wear the wooden shoes, you know. My father's mother is of the waters that flow together people, Tohiglini. My mother's father, my third clan, is also Tsin Bake Dene'e. And my fourth clan, my father's father's Totochitni, which is the Bitterwater clan, one of the original clans of our Navajo tribe. The next 45 minutes, I am going to present a history to you that most of you have never heard. It's going to be disturbing. It's going to deconstruct much of the past 12 to 16 years of your education. You're going to feel angry. A few of you are going to walk out. Some of you are going to want to throw something at me. Others of you are going to want to just shut down emotionally. I want to encourage you to stay engaged. I want to encourage you to stay in the conversation. We're going to come to a better place, but to get there, we first have to recognize and acknowledge what it is we're standing on and where we're coming from. Now, as we look through the lens of our nation, there are many things in our country that we don't know how to talk about, and we see that actually around us today. We are not sure how to talk about Terrence Crutcher, the African-American man who was shot just a few weeks ago. We don't know how to have that conversation. We don't know how to talk about Keith Lamont Scott, another person of color who was again killed just a few weeks ago. We don't know as a nation what to do with Colin Kaepernick, a very successful African-American athlete who defiantly yet respectfully takes a knee when he hears the national anthem played on the largest stage in our nation, which is the National Football League. We don't know what to do with that. We also don't know what to do about the Delaware, the Shawnee, the Iroquois, the people who were literally ethnically cleansed from this land so that this college could be built, so that homes could be bought, so that land could be settled. We don't know how to talk about that. And the reason we don't know how to talk about this thing is because there's a foundation to our nation, to our history, that we've never discussed. In 1452, Pope Nicholas V wrote down these words, "Invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens and pagans whatsoever. Reduce their persons to perpetual slavery. Convert them to his and their use and profit." These are the words in a papal bull written in 1452, and this papal bull, along with others between 1452 and 1493, collectively became known as what we call the Doctrine of Discovery. The doctrine of discovery is these series of papal bulls. It's essentially the church in Europe saying to the nations of Europe, wherever you go, whatever lands you find not ruled by Christian rulers, those people are less than human, and the land's yours for the taking. This was the doctrine that allowed European nations to go into Africa, colonize the continent, and enslave the African people. This is also the doctrine that let Columbus, who was lost at sea, land in a new world already inhabited by millions and claim to have discovered it. You cannot discover lands that are already inhabited. Right? If you don't believe me, leave your laptops, your cell phones, your car keys in front of you, and I will come by and discover them for you. That's stealing, right? That's conquering, that's conquest, that's colonizing. It's not discovery. The fact that to this day we celebrate that Columbus discovered America reveals the implicit racial bias of our nation. Natives are not fully human. This, of course, makes the doctrine of discovery a systemically racist doctrine that assumes the dehumanization of people of color. Now, in 1763, King George drew a line down the Appalachian Mountains, and he made a proclamation, and he said to the colonists that essentially they no longer had the right of discovery of the empty Indian lands west of Appalachia. This upset the colonists. So a few years later, they wrote a letter of protest. In their letter, they accused the king of raising the conditions of new appropriations of land. They went on in their letter to state he has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages. They signed their letter on July 4th, 1776. Literally 30 lines below the statement, "All men are created equal," the Declaration of Independence refers to natives as merciless Indian savages. Very clearly, the only reason our founding fathers used the inclusive term "all men" is because they had a very narrow definition of who was and who was not human. This, of course, makes our Declaration of Independence a systemically racist document that assumes the dehumanization of native peoples. Now, a few years later, our founding fathers wrote another document. They began this document with the words, "We the people," in order to form a more perfect union. Of course, this is the Constitution, the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. However, just a few lines later, in the section of the Constitution that defines who this document was written for and who is included as a citizen, Article 1, Section 2, it never mentions women, it specifically excludes natives, and it counts Africans as 3/5 of a person. So "we the people" literally means white landowning men. We have to wrap our head around that. The purpose of the Constitution was to protect the interest, to give justice to white landowning men. We have to stop being surprised that women earn 70 cents to the dollar. The Constitution's working. We have to stop being surprised our prisons are filled with people of color. The Constitution's working. We have to not be surprised that in 2010, Congress sided with Citizens United and ruled that corporations now have the same rights as individuals to political free speech. The Constitution is doing exactly what it was designed to do. It's protecting the rights of white landowning men. Now, maybe you're saying, "Wait, didn't we correct that?" About 100 years later, 1868 around, we passed the 14th Amendment. This is the amendment meant to address Article 1, Section 2. It extended the right of citizenship to anyone born on this continent under the jurisdiction of the government. However, it didn't give women the right to vote. Women didn't get that right until 1920 with women's suffrage. It didn't include natives. We weren't even citizens yet. And even when we did become citizens in 1924, many of our tribes didn't get the right to vote until 1948. So while the 14th Amendment extended the right of citizenship, a few of the rights of citizenship, we still had Jim Crow laws written after that, to a few former male slaves, it left marginalized and disenfranchised these huge segments of our population. And we forget that it was in 1973, this very same amendment, the 14th Amendment, was used in Roe versus Wade when the Supreme Court now concluded unborn babies aren't human, and therefore they can be aborted. What this demonstrates is that the heart of our Constitution is not a value for life. The value, the assumption, is dehumanization, and the value is for exploitation and profit. This, of course, makes our Constitution a systemically racist document that assumes the white landowning male has the authority to determine who is and who is not human. In 1823, we had a Supreme Court case, Johnson versus McIntosh. This is two men of European descent. They're litigating over a single piece of land. One of them got the land from a native tribe. The other one got the land from the government. They want to know who owned it. The case goes all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court had to decide the principle upon which land titles were based. They determined the principle was that discovery gave title to the government by whose subject or by whose authority it was made against all other European governments, which title might be consummated by possession. They went on to state that essentially based on the doctrine of discovery, natives, who were here first but are less than human, only have the right of occupancy to land, like a fish occupies water or a bird occupies air. And Europeans have the right of discovery to the land and therefore the true title to it. This, along with a few other cases during the Marshall Court era, created the legal precedent for land titles. This precedent and the doctrine of discovery were referenced by the Supreme Court as recently as 2005. This, of course, makes the United States Supreme Court a systemically racist court.
Well, this is a speech from Native American activist Mark Charles. He was an independent candidate for president of the U.S. in 2020, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa.
That has legal precedent based on the dehumanization of people of color. Initially, the Protestant Church pushed back against the doctrine of discovery. This was a Catholic doctrine. They didn't fully embrace it. In 1630, John Winthrop was in the Boston Harbor, and he preached a sermon called A Model of Christian Charity. In this sermon, he compared the colonists he was with to a city on a hill, borrowing from the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount to be a city on a hill, a lamp on a stand, telling his disciples to shine their good works into this dark world. He goes on in his sermon to exhort them in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberality to rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Not bad Christian exhortations. However, at the end of his sermon, John Winthrop begins quoting Deuteronomy chapter 30. This is the passage in the Bible where the people of Israel are at the banks of the Jordan River. They're about ready to cross over and take possession of their promised lands. And Moses is reiterating to them the threats and promises of their land covenant with the God of Abraham. If you obey God, he will do this to you. If you disobey, he will do these things to you. At the end of this passage, it says, "But if our hearts shall turn away so that we will not obey, and we worship other gods, we shall surely perish out of the good land, whether we pass over." Now, Deuteronomy 30 says river, but John Winthrop says vast sea. Why does he say vast sea? Well, he didn't cross a river. He crossed an ocean. So what's he implying? Based on the exhortation of Jesus to be a city on a hill, based on the model of Old Testament Israel, they are standing at the banks of their promised land, about ready to go and take possession of them. Now, who here has read the book of the Old Testament of the Bible of Joshua? What is God's command to the people in the book of Joshua to do to the people of Canaan? Kill everybody. Wipe them out. What's Israel's sin in the book of Joshua? They don't kill everybody. Promised lands for one people is literally God-ordained genocide for another. I call this sermon the birth of American exceptionalism. The idea percolates for about 100 years. Mid-1700s, we begin expanding westward as a nation. We go past the Appalachian Mountains. We go past the Mississippi River. towards the end of the 1700s, the Second Great Awakening begins happening. There's this religious fervor as our nation is moving further and further west. And early 1800s, the term manifest destiny is born. This belief that as a nation, we have the God-ordained right to rule this continent from sea to shining sea. Now that we have a racist doctrine of discovery, a racist Declaration of Independence, a racist Constitution, a racist Supreme Court, and a God-ordained right to commit genocide, now we have a bunch of history we've never talked about. I did some research about a year ago on our nation and war. And I looked at every year from 1775 to 2016 that our nation was in a state of war or armed military conflict against another country or entity. Every year in blue, I marked that we were in armed military conflict. I then went through and marked in red every year that we were fighting against native tribes. The list of wars at the bottom are merely the wars we fought against native peoples in the 19th century. We refer to the 19th century as our century of expansion. This is the century we added 30 states to the Union. Well, clearly this was not a century of expansion. This was a century of ethnic cleansing and genocide. It was during this century that we passed the Indian Removal Act, the act of Congress that allowed our nation by force in practice to remove nations from their lands in the east to empty lands further in the west. This resulted directly in the Trail of Tears for the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, and the Cherokee. This resulted in the Trail of the Long Walk for the Navajo. All told, about a dozen tribes experienced forced relocations, and tens of thousands of people died as a direct result of these relocations. In 1864, we had the Sand Creek Massacre. About 200 Cheyenne and Arapaho men, women, and children were encamped over a hillside in Colorado. A U.S. Army came over the hillside. They were led by a Methodist general. The native tribes were waving a white flag of surrender and an American flag to show they were there peacefully, and the Methodist leader ordered them all slaughtered. 200 people were killed that day. It was later reported their genitalia were paraded down the streets of Denver. In 1879, we had the Indian boarding school started in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, just up the road, the first Indian boarding school. Native children were forcibly taken from their homes, raised in these military-style boarding schools. They were punished for speaking their languages. They were punished for practicing their culture. They're removed from their families. The stated goal of these schools was to kill the Indian to save the man. The horror stories of abuse, neglect, sexual, mental, physical, emotional abuse is off the charts in these schools. The last of these schools didn't close until the 1970s and 80s. In 1887, we had the Dawes Act. Now that we had almost finished our expansion westward, the nation still wanted more land for white settlement. And so what they did is they allocated 160 acres to every native male over the age of 18. The rest of the native lands, which were now reservations, was opened up for white settlement. Over the next 30 to 40 years, this reduced the total land holdings of native peoples by about two-thirds. We lost in total a size of land roughly the area of California. In 1890, we had the massacre at Wounded Knee. This is one of the more famous massacres. 350 Native warriors were slaughtered in a single day. We teach this a little more frequently in our schools. What we don't talk about is that our United States government gave 20 Congressional Medals of Honor to the U.S. soldiers who participated in this massacre. Every effort to have these medals rescinded has been turned down. I actually found a quote by Senator John McCain advocating against their rescindment. December 19, 2009, Congress passed House Resolution 3326. This is the 2010 Department of Defense Appropriations Act, a 67-page bill laying out the budget for the DOD for 2010. Page 45, subsection 8113, is titled Apology to Native Peoples of the United States. What follows is the 7-bullet-point apology. It mentions no specific tribe, no specific treaty, and no specific injustice. It basically says you had some nice land. Our citizens didn't take it very politely. Let's just call it all of our land and steward it together. It then ends with a disclaimer stating nothing in here is legally binding. To date, this apology has not been announced, read, or publicized by the White House or by Congress. In our country, we don't teach a history of our nation. We teach a mythology. The mythology of America is discovery, equality, expansion, exceptionalism, and the belief that liberty and justice is for all. But that's the myth. It's not the reality. Who here has been to the Lincoln Memorial? Keep your hands up. Who's been to the museum at the base of the Lincoln Memorial? In the museum, at the base of the Lincoln Memorial, it's a room about the size of this front area. It's not very big. On each wall is writings and ideas and thoughts of President Abraham Lincoln on different aspects of his life and of our nation. And on one wall is a group of writings about his thoughts about the Union. And on that wall is a plaque. Etched in stone, the plaque's about 4 feet high, about 2.5 feet wide. And on the plaque, it says, "I would save the Union. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union. It is not to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. If I could save the Union by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. If I could save the Union by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that." There's a plaque at the Lincoln Memorial, etched in stone, that literally says, according to Abraham Lincoln, black lives don't matter. We don't teach a history of America. We teach a mythology. Instead of dehumanization, we call it discovery. We don't mention that our equality is only for a select few. Instead of ethnic cleansing, we call it expansion. Instead of genocide, we call it exceptionalism. And our liberty and justice is only for a very narrowly defined few. I want to take a short break here. I want to have a short, just emotional decompression. There's no right or wrong answer. There's no good or bad answer. In 2 or 3 words, I want you to tell me what you're feeling right now. 2 or 3 words. Anger, disgust, shame, confusion, surprise, not surprised, sadness, privilege, delusion, hope. Yeah. We don't talk about these things. This is our buried history. We don't know what to do with them. There's an Aboriginal leader out of Canada. His name is George Erasmus. And he says where common memory is lacking, where people don't share in the same past, there can be no real community. Where community is to be formed, common memory must first be created. I think this quote gets to the heart of our nation's problem with race. We don't have a common memory. We have a dominant white America that remembers a history of discovery, expansion, opportunity, and exceptionalism. And we have communities of color with the lived experience of stolen lands, broken treaties, slavery, ethnic cleansing, Jim Crow laws, segregation, internment camps, boarding schools, and all the other things that happened here. There's no common memory. Now, other nations around the world, South Africa, Rwanda, even Canada, have dealt with some of their colonial history or their violent past by having what are called truth and reconciliation commissions. National dialogues on race that deal with their history and try to create this common memory to speak the truth so they can find a way to move forward. I'm convinced our nation needs something like this. We need a national dialogue on race on par with a truth and reconciliation commission.
We're listening to a speech from Mark Charles. He's a Native American activist, a public speaker, a consultant, and an author on Native American issues. He writes for Native News Online, and he's been an opponent of the Dakota Access Pipeline. He's also a former pastor at the Christian Indian Center in Denver, Colorado. And this is 88.5 FM. Here's more of the talk by Mark Charles.
However, truth and reconciliation is almost a misnomer for our nation, because the context of our dialogue is around race. And so the reconciliation refers to a racial reconciliation. Now, first of all, race is a human construct. There's no genetic difference of race. And in the Americas, race was constructed for the purpose of oppressing and dividing. The black race was constructed in part through what's called the one-drop rule. What's the one-drop rule? Well, if you have a single drop of African blood, you're black. Why do we have this rule? Well, blacks were our slaves. They were our labor pool. We want as many of them as possible. The one-drop rule allowed a white slave owner to rape his female slave and produce free baby slaves. For natives, we have what's called the blood quantum rule. What's this? You're whole, you're half, you're a quarter, you're 16th, you're 32nd, you're 64th, then you're bred out of existence. Why? The myth of America is this land was empty. We discovered it. We don't want natives here. Race in this nation was constructed for the purpose of oppressing and dividing. And reconciliation implies a previous harmony. Racial reconciliation is a misnomer. All that word does is allow us to perpetuate the myth of America. Things were once great here, now they're not. We need a new term. I like to use the term racial conciliation. Conciliation is merely the mediation of a dispute. Racial reconciliation lets us perpetuate the myth. Conciliation requires us to have a much more honest starting point. They both can lead to a better place, but they just have a different starting point. So I'm advocating that we need a national truth and conciliation commission. A national dialogue to deal with who we are, where we've come from, and trying to find a way to move forward. Now the question is, how do you start this dialogue? In most nations, truth and reconciliation commissions came out of a major period of crisis. In South Africa, apartheid fell. That crisis was enough to bring the parties to the table. In Rwanda, there was this bloody civil war. That was enough to bring the parties to the table. In Canada, there was an over-the-top, hugely expensive lawsuit. It almost bankrupted the churches and it scared the crap out of the government. So they settled, and part of the settlement was they would have a truth and reconciliation commission. Now I know my country. I know our nation. We don't handle crisis well. I don't want to hope for, I don't want to pray for, I don't want to wait for, I don't want to initiate crisis. Our nation doesn't have it well. So what else do you do then? Well, there's a model of disruption. This is a model we've actually used fairly effectively in our country. This is the model Black Lives Matter is using right now. This is actually the model that the civil rights movement got started on. You disrupt the status quo, you co-opt the stage and you speak your message. Now the challenge with the disruption model is the strength of disruption is the act of disrupting. So someone has a stage, you disrupt the stage and you co-opt it. Now the minute you do that, one of two things are going to happen fairly quickly. Either the owner of the stage is going to take it back, or the audience is going to leave because they didn't come to hear you. So at best, you have a soundbite. Now, we've done some amazing things through disruption in this nation. Black Lives Matter is raising an incredible amount of awareness. The civil rights movement is what I would call our deepest dialogue we've ever had on race in our nation. But because if you're going to disrupt, if you don't want to lose your audience, you have to find a way to entice them to stay. So I think disruption is a great way to initiate a dialogue. I don't think it's a good way to sustain a deep dialogue. If you look at our civil rights movement, again, one of the deepest dialogues on race, and I have enormous respect for Dr. King, enormous respect for our leaders who engaged in this conversation. Some incredible things came out of this. But one of the challenges of our civil rights movement was the moral authority that we used for why we gave civil rights to African Americans. Remember what that moral authority was? It was our Declaration of Independence. That was the blank check referred to by Dr. King. That was the reason churches came to the table to have the conversation. So instead of critiquing ourselves and having the conversation that said we are racist down to our very declaration, down to our very foundations, we basically said we have a good foundation, we just have to be better Americans. Instead of challenging the implicit racial bias of our nation, we actually ended up affirming American exceptionalism. I'm convinced that's one of the reasons why Black Lives Matter is taking place today. We've actually never had the conversation about the fact that our very foundation state, Black Lives don't matter. So I'm not convinced disruption is going to work. Now, in the past year, we've seen a phenomenon unlike one we haven't seen in a long time in our country. The phenomenon of Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders did something that no one thought he could do, which is he changed the dialogue. He actually got our nation to talk about its systemic economic inequality. And how did he do that? He used the system we have built in to initiate a national dialogue. He ran for president. He forced every candidate to talk and take a position on our economic inequality. He forced media companies and journalists to write and report about this. He forced the dialogue to happen in the debates. He got our nation to actually look at and dialogue about our systemic economic inequality, and he did it by using the method we have built in, which is our presidential election cycle. I think that's what we need to do with race. I think we need to have a candidate who can run with our racist foundations at the heart of their candidacy, who can run with the idea, with the vision of a truth and conciliation commission at the heart of their platform, who can get this topic discussed in debates, written about by journalists, responded to by other candidates, can get our nation talking about it. I think this is what we need to do. I've spent a decade trying to ponder how do we address the issue of race. This is the best idea I've come up with of how we do this without disruption, without crisis, but actually bring the dialogue to the forefront. It's too late to do it in this election, so I'm aiming for the next election cycle, which begins in 2 years after the midterms, 2018. Now, to prep for this dialogue, there's three audiences I primarily want to get ready for this conversation. The first audience is the church. The church wrote the doctrine of discovery. They've been complicit in it for 500 years. I want the church to own it. I want the church to acknowledge what it's done and to own the doctrine of discovery and their complicitness in it. And I'm calling the church, when I speak to the church, into what I'm calling a season of lament. Lament is a tool from the scriptures that God gives the church to deal with their sin and their brokenness. And I'm trying to call the church. The book I'm writing on is coming out through a Christian publisher, and one of the focuses of the book is for the church to go into what I'm calling a season of lament. The second group I want to talk to is Native peoples, my own people. I want us to understand that we are not the helpless victims of an oppressive colonial government. We are the host people of the land. We have to act like the hosts. I love what's happening in North Dakota right now. Over 200 tribes are coming together to lead the conversation for our nation that says, no, we cannot continue to put economic prosperity above our environment. Water is life, is what we're telling our nation. You can't drink oil. I love the way our indigenous peoples are coming together as the role of the host people of this land. We are not going to let this senseless economic destruction continue. The third audience I want to address is communities of color. African American, Asian American, Latino, Native American, other minority communities within this nation. My message to other communities of color, you've heard of post-traumatic stress disorder, right? This is an individual diagnosis. PTSD is something that afflicts someone who's experienced, who's witnessed, who's been on the receiving end of violence. They get diagnosed with PTSD. There's another trauma known as historical trauma. Historical trauma is not an individual diagnosis as much as it's an understanding of the broader dissatisfaction in a community. You don't necessarily diagnose one person with historical trauma. It's how you understand the broader dissatisfaction. I like to refer to it as a multi-generational communal manifestation of PTSD. Now, there's another trauma out there called PITS, perpetration-induced traumatic stress. This is like PTSD in every way, shape, and form, except instead of afflicting the person who received the violence, PITS afflicts the person who caused or perpetrated the violence.
Well, this is a talk from Mark Charles, a Native American activist. He was an independent candidate for president of the U.S. in 2020. This is a talk that he gave in 2016. And you're listening to WMNF 88.5 FM.
It's based on this quote by Socrates that says, the doer of injustice is more miserable than the sufferer. So what I tell people is if there is a multi-generational communal manifestation of PTSD that we call historical trauma, I'm hypothesizing there is a multi-generational communal manifestation of PITS, which is what I'm identifying is the trauma that is afflicting white America, because you cannot build a nation on 500 years of dehumanizing injustice without traumatizing yourself. So I identify white America as another group of traumatized people. One of the first symptoms of trauma is shock and denial. When you understand white America as another group of traumatized people, it's easy to see their symptoms. This buried apology by our Congress, that's not racism, that's trauma. They're so overwhelmed by what they did, they can't even talk about it. We have Texas and Oklahoma passing laws saying you can only teach patriotic history. That's not racism, that's trauma. They're so overwhelmed by what they did to become who they are, they can't even teach it anymore. We have the civil rights movement using the Declaration as a moral authority. That's deflection. That's trauma. American exceptionalism is merely the coping mechanism of a nation in deep denial of its genocidal past and its current racist reality. When you deal with trauma patients, you also deal with what are called triggers. Triggers is something that takes you out of reality, a sight, a sound, a smell, something takes you out of reality and into the chaos of the moment when the traumatic event happened. When you understand white America as a traumatized people group, it's easy to see their triggers. 7 years of a black president is a trigger. Without President Obama, Donald Trump never rises. Any sort of national dialogue on gun control is a trigger. We can't have that conversation without screaming at each other. I identify ISIS as a trigger. Why is ISIS a trigger? Well, they're a group of religious zealots ethnically cleansing a land to set up their own pseudo-religious empire. That reflection is so awfully familiar, white America doesn't know what to do with it. That's why Paris gets bombed and somehow it's all about them. It's all about us. We don't know what to do. So I'm not trying to convince white America they're traumatized. I'm trying to convince people of color that white America is traumatized. Why? Because we know our communities are jacked up. I know my reservation's a mess. We know that we're traumatized. We know, we're aware of what's going on. Not that we're healed, but we're aware that we're in a mess. The problem is we have this belief that white America came out of that same history unscathed. And so because of that, we tend to look at white America like they can fix it. Problem is, white America can't fix it. White America does not have the tools in their tool belt to fix the problem. What does white America bring to the table? Well, first they bring their money, which is all blood money. Second, they bring their understanding of liberty and justice and freedom, which their own documents define are for a very narrowly select few. They can't fix it. I have a daughter, she's 7 years old. She could pull the parking brake on my car, let it roll down the hill, and crash into a tree. She could wreck my car. She hasn't, but she could. I could scream at her all I want. She can't fix it. Screaming at her only frustrates me and paralyzes her. When we scream at white America, people of color, to fix it, we frustrate ourselves, we paralyze them. We need to understand we are dealing with another group of traumatized people. And so when they go into shock and denial, when white America begins to manifest some of their triggers, just like when you're with a counselor, if you've ever been to a counselor and you start getting onto a hot topic and you begin emotionally boiling, rarely does your counselor get into there and mix it up with you, right? Why? Your counselor understands, this is good, we're making a connection. You need the space to express yourself, but I'm not going to let you take things over. I'm not going to let you run it. You're traumatized. White America, we need to treat them as another group of traumatized people. In most racial dialogues, white America is either racist or they're fragile. I don't think either one of those are helpful places to start the conversation. If white America is merely racist, there's no place for them in this conversation. If white America is fragile, it means we have to walk around on eggshells around them. By understanding white America is traumatized, not victimized, traumatized by their own history, by what they're standing on, we can understand that it's actually good when they begin to have these reactions because something's being touched. It is good when something gets touched and you begin to make a connection. You have to find a way to build on that, not let it take over the entire situation. One of the challenges with our nation is that we've never lost a war that's mattered. Because of that, we've never had to turn around as a nation under the scorn of the globe and say, we probably shouldn't have done that. When World War II ended, Germany demilitarized themselves and began teaching the Holocaust. Why? So they could do it better next time? No, so they'll never do it again. When Japan lost the war, they demilitarized. They didn't want to go near what happened to them the first time. After we dropped bombs, killing tens of thousands of people in a single instant, what did we do? We ramped up our nuclear arsenal. We've never lost a war that matters. We've never had to look back under the scorn of the globe and say we probably shouldn't have done that. But that's what we need to do. Because where common memories lacking, where people do not share in the same past, there can be no real community. If we as a nation want to build a better community, we have to start by creating a common memory. I'm convinced what our nation needs is a national truth and conciliation commission. We need a national dialogue on race. Right now, there's a dialogue that's going on in this country. A year ago, in his last State of the Union, President Obama, he quoted our Constitution, and he said, "We the people, we've come to acknowledge that means all of us." Now, that sounds beautiful, but when I heard that, I was like, really? I didn't know we ever concluded that. I didn't get that memo. That seems to be the dialogue we're having this political campaign. Donald Trump seems to be very clear on who We the People includes and doesn't include. We the People does not include Muslims. It does not include immigrants from the South. It does not include women. He's quite clear on that. The challenge with Donald Trump is he actually understands what made America great in the first place. Explicit and systemic racism. And he's like, let me champion it again. Let me bring it back. Now, the challenge is Hillary is not his antithesis. Donald Trump says what? Make America great again. What does Hillary say? America's great already. We've always been great. America's great because we're good. So what do they agree on? Our history, our past, our foundations are great. At the Democratic National Convention, Cory Booker, an African-American senator from New Jersey, stood up and he acknowledged the word savages in the Declaration. He acknowledged the Three-Fifths Compromise in the Constitution, but he bookended that section of his speech by saying, our founders are geniuses and our foundations are great. You can't say that unless your definition of great is racist. The dialogue we're having right now is not a racist, anti-racist conversation. The dialogue we're having this political cycle is, do we want Donald Trump to champion explicit racism, or do we want Hillary Clinton to work to keep racism implicit? And that conversation is freaking us out. Because since the civil rights movement, we've grown very comfortable with implicit racism and very uncomfortable with explicit racism.
This is 88.5 FM, and we're listening to a talk from Native American activist Mark Charles.
And we cannot be fooled. We are not having a racist, anti-racist dialogue right now. We need a national truth and conciliation. We need to deal with the fact that the United States of America is systemically racist because of our foundations, not in spite of them. And that's the dialogue I'm trying to initiate. That's the conversation I'm trying to get our people to think about and talk about. We need to create a common memory. And until we do, we are not going to experience true community. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Natalie, and I'm a junior here, and I had a question about the doctrine of discovery. I was under the impression that, like, the kind of idea that Europeans had about non-white Europeans was kind of already in place. Would you say that the doctrine of discovery kind of provided an outlet or an excuse to act on that idea, or do you think it provided the idea?
Yeah, no, the doctrine of discovery is the fruit, essentially. In other lectures I give, I identify the doctrine of discovery as the fruit of basically the church in the third century getting into bed with the empire. And it's the conversion of Constantine, the creation of Christendom in the third century, that leads to, because the church never had the idea that it would be a Christian empire. Jesus was clear in his teachings. He came, his kingdom was of this earth. Constantine creates this extra-biblical idea of a Christian empire. So in the fourth century, there's a dilemma, which is the empire is doing what empires do, which is expand and protect itself through war. A plain text reading of scripture doesn't allow that, so we need Augustine to do some theological gymnastics and create a just war theory, explaining why the empire cannot act Christian. Over the centuries, the just war theory morphs into the Crusades. In the 12th century, the 1300s, the writings of the papal bulls begin to express a new category of other, which it calls infidels. It's primarily used to refer to the Moors or the Muslims. It's a category of other. Later, it's applied to indigenous peoples. Once it creates this category of other, this infidel, now you don't even need a just war theory to go to war, because now you can base your wars on theological grounds. We're fighting the other. That's what allows in the 14th century, or the 1400s, the explicit writings of the doctrine of discovery which say, invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens and pagans whatsoever. Once you've otherized the group, now you can do whatever you want to them. So I identify the Doctrine of Discovery very much as the fruit of the church getting into bed with the empire back in the 3rd century. This is a great question.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hello, my name's Arik, and I'm a junior. Thank you so much for your talk. I think it's the most important conversation we need to have in this country. I'm asking this question as a Palestinian and Armenian American, but I think it applies to everyone who has buried history. How do you have these difficult conversations with people, and how do you, as a person who has historical trauma from that's been passed down through your family and through your culture, deal with the questions that can be offensive or difficult to answer as a response?
One of the hardest things to do is to have this conversation. I completely agree with this. This is a very good question you're asking. As far as dealing with my own historical trauma, part of the tools you use to engage the dialogue is if you're just aware that you're dealing with trauma yourself. That's the biggest difference between white America and most communities of color, is white America is they are still in the stage of shock and denial. They don't understand they're traumatized, which is what makes it incredibly difficult for them to lead and in some points even engage in the conversation. So one of the things for myself as a Native man, and I'll just share the story very briefly, when I first moved back to our reservation after living around the country and other places, I was really kind of taken back by how deeply marginalized our people were, and I was experiencing and seeing for the first time the fruits of all this historical trauma and this historical oppression. And I was trying to engage that dialogue with my friends. But every time I went into the conversation, I would get angrier and angrier and angrier and angrier until either I would have to start yelling or hang up the phone. So then I began to temper myself, disconnect emotionally. I could stay in the conversation longer, but then the defenses of my friends went up. That wasn't my family that did that. I didn't kill your people. And soon they would drop out of the conversation. So I was writing a letter to some friends of mine for like their 10th time, trying to get them to understand what I was feeling. And in my letter, I said, being Native American and living in the United States, it feels like our Native communities are this old grandmother who has a very large and a very beautiful house. And years ago, some people came into our house and they locked us upstairs in the bedroom. Today, our house is full of people. They're sitting on our furniture, they're eating our food, they're having a party inside our house. They've since come upstairs and unlocked the door to our bedroom, but it's much later and we're tired, we're old, we're weak, and we're sick, so we can't or we don't come out. But the thing that hurts us the most, what causes us the most pain, is that virtually nobody from this party ever comes upstairs, seeks out the grandmother in the bedroom, sits down next to her on the bed, takes her hand, and simply says thank you. Thank you for letting us be in your house. I wrote that and I'm like, that's it. I started sharing that, and other Native peoples would say, I've lived on the reservation all my life. I've never been able to articulate how I feel, and you hit the nail on the head. I shared that with non-Natives, and they would say things like, what does it mean to say thank you? How does my family, my community, my nation express gratitude to Indigenous peoples? Now we're having a very different dialogue. Now instead of wrenching guilt into people, we're having a dialogue about what I would call this reversal of roles, which is we have 300 million undocumented immigrants running around like they own the place. And we have 6 million Indigenous peoples acting like unwanted guests in someone else's home. We have to reverse that dialogue. And it's as I've looked for ways to make this dialogue as inclusive as I possibly can, by understanding I'm dealing and my community is dealing with its own trauma, and by understanding white America is another group of traumatized people, that allows me, when I hear backlash, when I get confrontational questions, when I see the denial, rather than assuming this is a racist attack on me, I'm assuming this person is traumatized.
You've been listening to a talk from Mark Charles. He's a Native American activist. He was an independent candidate for president in 2020, and he's been active in his opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline. This has been WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. If you want to comment about this program, call us at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. Stay tuned for...